The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
I'd like to introduce now our three panelists. The first one here is my left is Greg Riley. Greg is a psychic medium and he is the one. He's the best psychic in Australia. He won the 2011 Channel 7 TV show.
It's 2013, it's been displaced.
Yeah, I haven't seen you.
They haven't run a series since then.
He's a former.
He's the reigning champion.
Reigning champion, yeah.
There hasn't been another series.
You might be the champion forever.
In perpetuity.
That's right.
You know that.
Oh, she knows that. Yes. Anyway, Greg is based here in Melbourne, and we're very privileged to have Greg Riley with us. Please welcome Greg.
Look at Ian doing a token hand.
Our next panellist is, he may not require so much of an introduction, but Dick Gross. Dick has written and broadcast on a godless perspective for over a decade, and he is the author of the popular blog, well, less popular blog perhaps now, The Godless Gross, since it was axed from The Age earlier this year, but he's still running The Godless Gross. Dick's the author, also author of a few books, and he's got a book here on death by elegy. And he's an entertaining, interesting person, so please welcome Dick Gross. And our final panellist today is Ian Power. Ian now works for the City Bible Forum and speaks nationally and internationally, engaging the big questions of life. He's recognised as one of Australia's leading Christian communicators, and he works with the City Bible Forum based in Sydney, but he's down here for a few days. So please welcome Ian Powell.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for that insight. We're here for a respectful and reasonable and rigorous discussions with sound effects as well. Thanks, Dick. Yeah. Now, this isn't the first time that these three gentlemen have attended a forum, participated in a forum at the City Bible Forum. 18 months ago, we ran a lunchtime forum called Angels and Demons. Is there a spiritual dimension? It was an immensely stimulating and popular session that we had. It still remains one of our most popular lunchtime forums. So we thought it'd be worthwhile... It has been a very popular discussion. People are still not many people are talking about it anymore.
Almost like being the 2011 number one.
That's right.
Probably
look
at the past.
That's right.
I think about it occasionally. Anyway, so welcome again.
We welcome Ian. Said the last time you three debated, we had a lot of criticisms about it because you were too soft.
Okay, we're going to go hard this time.
We've got to go hard. There's got to be blood, tears.
But you have a steak.
So we do have some steaks. Whoever is we could work out who's going to be the first one on the steak. Anyway, so tonight's discussion is we're talking about things that we don't normally talk about, and we're talking about death, and particularly life before death and life after death. Now, Dick, you're an atheist. You've written a book on death. Tell us... why would an atheist write a book on death, and what is death? What do you want to share?
Okay, look, death is clearly the difficult area for atheists to contemplate. You know, the old aphorisms are, there are no atheists in a foxhole, you know, a dead atheist is on a slab all dressed up and nowhere to go. Death is our major challenge to make ourselves attractive as a belief system to humanity. So yeah, like we do death badly, but we, you know, we would argue that we do it correctly. But I just thought I'd start off, whilst I've got the microphone. My book looks at a poem about death by Tom Gray, an Anglican, who wrote it 250 years ago. And I just wanted to take through just a few of the ideas that Thomas Gray says. I'll just set the scene. So it's his elegy written in a country churchyard. So he's sitting in a country churchyard at the end of the day, and the death of the day is sort of emblematic of the death of humanity. One thing you should know about Tom Gray was that he was one of 12 children, but only he survived. So death was an overwhelming narrative in his family. And it's no surprising that he wrote one of the most beautiful and insightful works on death that there is, because it was a subject his family tragically could not avoid. So this was written 250 years ago. I just wanted to read the first three verses just to get you in the mood of the dying day. The curfew tolls the knell of parting day. The lowing herd winds slowly o'er the lea. The ploughman homeward plods his weary way and leaves the world to darkness and to me. Now fades the glimmering landscape on the sight, and all the air a solemn stillness holds, save where the beetle wheels his droning flight, and drowsy tinklings lull the distant folds. So that's where he is. He's in a quiet place, in a contemplative place, and in a place of death. Because unlike our society, where we incarcerate the dead in places that are invisible to our community, this is a community where death sits cheek by jowl with life. So he looks over at a pack of yew trees and he says, "Beneath those rugged elms that yew trees shade, where heaves the turf in many a mouldering heap, each in his narrow cell forever laid, the rude forefathers of the hamlet sleep." So it's completely different to death in the modern community, where, you know, we're baked and and thrown away. We barely get any memorial. I think we do death in the modern world, be we believer or unbeliever, appallingly, because we don't build those edifices. So a lot of the poems about the sort of edifices that the villagers build for themselves once they've died. Now, death is invisible, unspeakable in monsters. This has got nothing to do with atheism versus theism. This is modernity. And so it's a really interesting perspective of death for us to look back a quarter of a millennium and think about. And then he talks a lot about destiny and legacy. And I could go on, and I have to. And I have to read just one more verse, and I can't find it. But here we go. So he talks about nobility, power, beauty, and wealth in the first two lines. So the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all the beauty, all the wealth e'er gave, awaits alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. So I'll hand it over, but it's incredibly powerful language about death. And given that it's in the context of achievement, legacy, and our terrestrial legacy, his argument is that we all end up dead, and that what's important for these villagers is their nexus with community, which I think we've lost. So I think that life and death is sort of harder in modernity.
So I think you're saying a couple of things there, Dick. So you're saying that death is somewhat invisible to us in our modern society, but then in light of death, it affects how we should live and engage the world today. Would that be a fair kind of reflection?
Yeah, look, I think it depends on your experience. Now, my daughter, who's 22, has six acquaintances who've died. It's amazing. It's awful. So her narrative about death is not typical, but the typical one is that we're all going to live to a great age, we're going to die invisibly in an institution. Half of our friends will have died. Maybe even some of our kids might have died. And the fear of death is, for those great majority of people, abating. and invisible. And, you know, people are talking. I mean, this guy, Tom Gray, would be amazed that we've got, you know, euthanasia clubs. He'd be amazed. You know, they endured any pain to live. We get a little bit of a pain and think, oh, God, we've got to kill ourselves off. We're a blight on society. We're not enjoying life. And he'd be amazed at the length of our lives and the extraordinary richness in a physical term of our lives. So life and death in the 250 years has altered dramatically. And I think the fear of death has changed, unless you get a youngie dead.
Today it can be a really confronting experience, perhaps.
It's everyone's nightmare, burying a child.
So, Dick, you still haven't kind of. So, we're still intrigued to say your take on death then. So, it's still this, the atheist's big problem, and it is something that we don't talk about much. But, so how should an atheist, or how does an atheist kind of view it then?
There are two famous atheists who disagree. So, Sigmund Freud said we should be open about it, and Ernst Becker, who wrote the famous book, and interestingly said that faith is a legitimate and good consolation in the face of death, and that's why I don't, you know, bash Christianity for this belief. He says that we should suppress death. We can't talk about it all the time. And a little bit of suppression and a little bit of fantasy dreaming about the afterlife and salvation after death is not a bad thing. You know, you're on Earth for a small amount of time. Does it matter that, you know, heaven and hell may or may not exist? So, so in terms of your question, there is debate. There's the Ernst Becker line who says it's okay to lie about death and suppress it. And then there's the and I sort of agree with that. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Sigmund Freud one, who's got the harsh classic atheist death: once you're dead, you're dead. And or in Bertrand Russell's once you're dead, you're dust.
To deal with it.
Deal with it. Get, you know, stop being a sookie sookie lala and deal with it. Like, incredibly harsh, unforgiving, gives atheism a bad name.
So there's the suppress it or the kind of deal with it. Now, when we bring you on into the conversation, you know, Greg, so you're, I don't know what you can react to what Dick has just said, but obviously, I mean, you deal with it. You exist in a couple of different worlds. You're in the corporate world, working in an office here in the city where you're, you know, doing business and so on like everybody else, but you're also dealing with the world of outside of that in terms of, you know, engaging the spiritual world and so on. Do you want to, well, your reactions to what Dick says, and also in terms of the enigma of death, the reality of it, the suppression or the dealing with it? Thoughts?
I suppose, first of all, I don't think you're going to find you and I actually too far apart in some of the stuff. When I deal with death...
You know what happens if we don't fight...
We get in bed together.
No. If we don't fight, he's going to be upset.
No, I'm happy for...
So we're going to have to manufacture a dispute.
We're just not going to get as many YouTube
hits. When I deal with death every day, and look, and so forth, I've had eight friends also. From drug overdose, gassing themselves, drowning, hanging themselves. So, and I see today, like, depression is like cancer proportion stuff at the moment. And for you guys, and you see that coming through, is that we've got an epidemic in our shores at the moment as far as depression, anxiety goes between people. And I seem to deal with all that stuff every single day. But also the other fact is that This is a surreal world. This is not who we are. And for those who have seen Avatar, the movie Avatar,
I confess,
that's the sort of what I see.
Grant me absolution.
That's what I sort of see us happening. We're an avatar. This body is an avatar. We project into this body. Our spirit, our soul projects into it. And we play out a scene. We play out a play. And then when the life's over, we go back to our home. So death for me is actually an uplifting and quite joyous experience.
Whereas reuniting yourself with your
who you are. Back to, and my background is, like, I'm a Roman Catholic, so I was brought through for that kind of stuff. So I still believe in God, I still believe in Jesus. So it's a bit strange for a psychic to believe in that, but I'm not even all psychic, as you can see.
We'll find that out a bit later.
But I think it's a very it's very dangerous to play that dust is dust, and some people get a good life, some people get a bad life, because I believe everyone has got a chance to experience life the best way they can, and if you've been given a bum steer as far as life goes, well, then what's the point? You might as well knock yourself off now.
Yeah. Look, it's just the...
Bad aside.
It's just the atheist worldview is really evidence-driven.
Yep.
So this is where you and I will part. So, yep. You know, atheists are all evidence-driven, and like, in one sense, you know, Christians are, because they say they've got a book which is evidence. Mm-hmm. So, so we
ask a question. Can you measure love?
You can.
How?
By doing...
When has science proved love?
Well...
I think I stumped him.
Okay. You would do it by subjective rather than objective analysis.
Can you guys measure love? How do you measure love? But do you believe there's love? How do you know that? Why?
Sitting here.
Yeah. How do you feel? Is that your husband? How do you feel about your husband? A pretty bad question.
No, but that's evidence. It's not quantifiable.
It's not
qualitative evidence.
It's not a scientific proof.
No, yes,
there's
it
no
is.
No electrodes hooked up to her.
Yeah. But no, but that's a.
That's faith.
That is a characterisation.
If you're on a deathbed, brain waves, heartbeat, and mental activity are scientific proof of life. And that goes beyond the initial fundamental five qualifiers in life, which is,
I'd hate to get to my deathbed and actually experience love.
No, it's about the measurement. I mean, you can measure certain things. You can measure emotions through the ECG. You can measure it qualitatively rather than quantitatively through qualitative surveys like, do I love? Yes, I do. Therefore, it exists. You can't put a cardinal number on it because we don't have a scale. You might be able to put an ordinal number on it saying, I love her less now than I did in the past, or I... So you can put comparative stuff, but it is manifest, it is evidenced by testimony.
Which definition of love are you measuring that?
It's all subjective.
we'll
I reckon I've answered your question. I think I've got you there.
We'll move back to the topic of evidence, I think, a little bit later. But concentrating at this stage on the nature of death, and is it the kind of, and especially particularly reflecting on the atheist response, suppress it or kind of deal with it. And maybe do you want to add in, what's your comment on the kind of, as Dick outlined, the two views of the atheist view of death, suppress it, deal with it. What are your thoughts?
We discovered some time ago that we're both fans of Ernst Becker's The Denial of Death, for different reasons, although I need to admit I haven't finished it. Dick made the comment that we're not perhaps as frightened of death as we used to be. I'm not. I don't know if that's the case.
That's anecdotal.
Yeah, I think I wonder sometimes when people sometimes tell me I'm not frightened of death. I tend not necessarily to believe that. I think if you pulled a gun out on them, and I looked crazy, and I'm religious, so I'm just as liable to do that. I think people would get frightened. I think often people haven't thought much about death, but I think in the end, when people speak of the power of the gun, what they're talking about is the power of the fear of death. So I do think at the heart of human beings is quite a healthy fear of death. That's what keeps us alive often. And that's not a bad thing. But I think it's a shame for humans to live unwilling to think about the one certainty. You know, like young people that assume that they may travel, assume they may have sex, we assume we may one day be happy, etc. The one thing we know about ourselves is the destination. And I think it's worth, it seems a shame to have constructed a way of life where you never think about the one certainty. And I think our society has conspired together, and this is, Ernst Becker talks about this, our society has conspired together to hide ourselves from the terrible reality. So you go to a lot of funerals and you would think it was a wedding in terms of flowers. Now I get we send flowers as a statement of love to the people who've lost someone, but I wonder sometimes with the beauty of the coffin and the beauty of the flowers on the coffin, that what we're trying to do is hide ourselves from the fact that something almost without exception horribly awful has happened here. Unless the person's a complete nightmare, like Pol Pot, in which case we all dance, right? Death always means the ripping apart of relationships. So when my father died 12 years ago, it was a good death. You know, he actually died exactly the way he wanted. He had a good last day, etc. But it's still sad. It's still sad for Mum. There are times when I wish he was here. I wasn't overly close, but I think any death tears apart relationships, and I think that's awful. And even in wedding services, in the classic Christian wedding service, you made the promise until we're parted by death. Now that's still available, but you have a choice, which is as long as life lasts, which is saying exactly the same thing, but we've just removed the word death. And I think we actually do ourselves a real disservice not at some stage really looking this bastard in the eye and saying, what is it? Where does it come from? And then the question is obviously about what's on the other side, which at so many modern funerals is the question that almost everyone's asking, but no one's allowed to speak. So we turn life in England, which apparently the most frequent song played at funerals now is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, which is a fun song and it's got a place. But there's something sad about that you can't, you go to funerals, I go to concert, no one talks about the fact this is a horror in many ways. We simply say, let's celebrate the life, which is part of the story. So I think...
But I think we're being a bit de-skilled in death, because death is far less frequent. So we're de-skilled, particularly in the ritual of death, particularly if you're not involved in a religious community. So, you know, I go to lots of funerals, and people don't know what to do, because we're hopeless at community singing, so we don't do that. So we play records, you know, so they'll play the Stones or the Beatles, because that's the demographic. And then they'll play some classical music as we enter, because even though they never play classical music in their life. And then we'll have the photo montage beamed at us through the TV screens, and it's incredibly sterile. You know, it could be at work looking at a PowerPoint.
That's right. Actually, there's been a couple of questions come through the text messages here, and I'll try to incorporate some of this. So there's one particularly under you, Dick, so that's not we're not trying to pick on you, but... we'll pick on you,
don't worry,
we'll pick on the others at other points. But I suppose it's a question that is...
Do one for him!
Oh, we're going to get to Greg soon. But I suppose it's a question that may open up some further dialogue and discussion. So are you personally scared of dying?
Oh, no, I'm terrified. When I say that it's abated, it's only abated in small communities. And I think the myth of the afterlife is still a resonant part of our culture. People in America don't talk about dying, they talk about passing.
Mm. So would this be the kind of the concept that... We talk about, I know it was one of my favourite, maybe I'm showing my age or my musical tastes, but one of my musical people that I followed or listened to a lot was Billy Joel, and he wrote a song after his daughter asked him what happens when you die, and he said, well, a piece of you kind of, your memory lasts in somebody else's memory, and you continue on, but through the memories of other people.
Yeah,
so is that, okay. That's the same kind of concept.
That's right, and that's essentially ephemeral. You know, we're all, it's when you take it to its logical conclusion. Can I tell you about another one?
Use the microphone just for a second. I want it back.
So the other song, of course, is Would You Know My Name If I Met You in Heaven? Mm.
at Micromechanics.
Mm. No. What's
Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton. So Clapton's son died falling off by accident off a high tower when he was about 3 or 4. So he writes this song, would you know, Tears in Heaven.
Tears in Heaven.
Yeah. And he asks this rhetorical question, would you know my name if I met you in heaven? So he's sort of going to the heart of the atheistic attack on the notion of heaven, which is, what person goes to heaven? So if you're a child who dies at birth, are you still a child without life, without experience in heaven? Or if you're demented, are you still a demented person without a memory of anything in heaven? Very challenging song. But this is irrelevant. Question, am I scared of dying? Shit, yes.
I won't quote that, but Greg, let's go to you. We'll ask the same question to both you and Ian. Actually, maybe we'll go to you first, Ian, then we'll come to you, Greg. What about you? Are you scared of dying? Are you scared of death, Ian?
Yeah, I think it's certainly in some way the idea of it's muddled because the process of dying is normally not much fun, and I don't enjoy things that aren't much fun.
Hedonist.
Yeah, I mean, I like pleasure. I think we're supposed to. And I think humans are hardwired for life. So I think when people talk about not being concerned, anxious, frightened, terrified of death, they're just probably not thinking about the reality of them dying, of me dying. At the same time, I am enormously looking forward to what will be on the other side. And not because I've got a fantasy that I've made up. What I believe about life after death has got things that are frankly better, which is why I think when the few times in the Bible even talks about what it is patently absurd language that it uses. And it knows it's doing it because it's trying to describe, the best verse really is that the mind of man has not seen, nor the eye of man has not seen, nor the mind of man conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. It's for me, the picture for me is it's like describing the beauties of life or the horrors of life to an unborn baby. How do you describe a mango to a baby? It's got all the machinery. It will, God willing, one day eat a mango, but you can't possibly describe the mango because you'd say it's like a peach, but that's useless. And yet it's got all the machinery to do it, and it will. And I think that's the situation humans are in. But hell is also a thing that haunts me as well. And so the Christian view of life after death, some of my friends at funerals who've been to them will say to me things like, well, this is probably easy for you, and it's not. Sometimes I go to funerals and I think, I'd like Jesus to be wrong. And he might be, but I want evidence to convince me.
Actually, just another question has kind of come in which relates exactly to that point. So, to clarify, the point is, to Ian, isn't death only a horror for non-believers or non-Christians?
No, I think death itself, the ending of life, I will withdraw to my position of safety. I just think in verse, there's a very helpful verse that I was reading today, just trying to remember what Jesus actually says about death. And death is described as the last enemy. In the Bible, unlike a lot of my friends in the circle of life and all this sort of stuff, the Bible always sees death as an enemy. And it will be, it has been defeated by one person who says he will share that victory with others. But death is itself not seen as a friend, even though sometimes it comes partly as a relief. But even for my friends who are sick, I don't want them to die too soon, because I don't want them to go from one pain into what, according to Jesus, and he is the hell guy in the Bible, is unspeakably worse. So, but death itself, yuck, still. But I'm genuinely excited about what Jesus says there is on the other side.
Thanks. So death, yep, scared. I want to go there. Ian, yep,
not so scared, but there's some kind of, of course, it's an icky kind of thing. How about you, Greg? Are you scared of dying?
I think it's, personally, yeah, of course I am, because you miss the ones that you do love. I mean, you miss your family and your dog and all that kind of stuff. But I do, Charlie. Right. I think having that fear of death is actually probably a good thing as well, too, because it also keeps constraints around what we do in this life as well, too, because if you sort of have no fear of death and you knew what was on the other side, why would you come here? You just go back? Because if we feel so good on the other side, which it is, you go, well, why am I sitting here paying taxes and listening to Julia Gillard screw me over even more when I can just go back home? So I think it's very important that we have that veil where we actually have that doubt that is there something on the side? Do we believe or not believe? Because if we come here for a physical experience, and I think it's quite vital that we do have that fear, because it keeps boundaries around society to a certain point. So.
Okay, that's interesting.
I'd have to say there are two really pathetic atheist consolation in the face of death. The first is like the circle of life thing, that death is necessary for life. That, you know, because we believe in evolution, we evolved on the basis of the death not only of literally billions of plants and animals, but billions of species have died in order to create humanity, and, you know, we have to shuffle off to be part of that process. For me personally, the consolation factor, zero. The second consolation...
We'll come to your funeral, though.
Thanks, Greggy.
We'll put the pictures up there and yeah. the screens and just, yeah.
Oh, no. I want to get people to sing because I'm into liturgy. But the other thing is, atheists would say that we are used to non-existence. So we haven't existed before we were born, and that wasn't so bad. It was neutral. And we will not exist when we die. And that'll be the same as not having been born. Now, I say that's a very unconsoling argument, because it fails to take into account the revelation of living. So once you've had the insight of life, you can't say, well, I've been non-existent since the beginning of time, therefore I'm used to it. Like, you know, hey, I've lived. Living's better than non-existence. So once again, you know, atheism really struggles to come up with consolation in the face of death.
Just one other thing, just before because we'll probably move on from this. I think one of the sad things, I took a friend's father's funeral the other week, and I spent a bit of time looking at some of the... I always get there early, unlike tonight. I always get the things like that early, because you don't want to be late for weddings or funerals. Oh, that's what you... But I looked at a lot of the memorials...
Well, my pants on fire.
And they say things like, you know, remembered forever, and that's always bull. Like, when a person... unless you're a monster... Unless you're a Genghis Khan or an Alexander the Great, most ordinary, decent people die. There's a pinprick of sorrow on the human race because of our death. Some people will be sad. We'll all get over it. And in a generation, I mean, who cares about my grandfather? Nobody cares about him.
You've got a pretty big interest in him.
Yeah, but I have a debt to him, but I think in the end, it's one of the other illusions that we live up in the memory of those who love us. We're remembered by the insignificant, which doesn't help, and they're also marching to exactly the same end. So I think it is a false comfort. I get why people write it. They have to use the word forever for some reason. But in the end, it's not true. Most people, except monsters, basically, die and are forgotten.
It's spooky, though, because in the book I argue that, you know, of course, we're all ephemeral, we're all... going to be forgotten, but unless you're Hitler. George Bush, he's forgotten already. Yeah. They're all gone. I talk about the Sir Robert Menzies effect. So my daughter went to the same school as Sir Robert Menzies, the longest serving Prime Minister of this country. She was taught in a building called the Robert Menzies Building. So I go up to her and I say, she's an engineer, so forgive her, she's stupid. And I say, Bubba, who's Sir Robert Menzies? Oh, shut up! I don't know. So, you know, this is a man who strode over this country like a titan. Yeah, I remember him because we went to his funeral to
make sure he's dead.
Make sure he's dead. Yeah, we went to Springvale and held up a sign because he was famous for saying this statement saying better red than dead. Oh, better dead than red. So we had better dead than red ? We didn't get bashed up, but like it was getting pretty ugly there for a while.
You could join that crazy little family church.
The Westboro
Baptist.
Yeah, it sounds like you've started your own.
Yeah.
A question has come in. I said a few other questions, and we'll try to get to them. But Dick, just before we move on from this topic, I'd really like to talk a bit more about life after death. And but do you think people invent religions because of their insecurity of death?
Well, look, the relationship between death and the popularity of faith is inextricably bound. You don't know whether it's what the causal relationship, whether religion was invented to recruit people scared of death, which is all of us, or people invented religions which massage their psychological erogenous zones to make them less scared of death. So I don't know about the causal relationship, but it's inextricably bound up. And later we'll get on to why I can't believe in death. But
sure, okay. Well, I mean, what about you, Ian?
I can't believe in the afterlife.
What do you make of Dick's comment about that essentially that religion is the result of after your death or insecurity?
Yeah, I think it's hard for us not to get muddled. I mean, I don't want to mock... I shouldn't mock anyone, but I don't want to have a cheap shot at Freud, who I'm not an expert on. But when Europeans speak about the origins of religion, and Freud's just working off Feuerbach's work, he's the great guy who says religion is this, you know, dealing with our insecurities and projecting into the heavens the father figure. That's an entirely European view of God. The great bulk of the religions of the world are purely about getting, they're not even death focused, I don't think. Most of the ordinary religions of the world, the ones that you would have met in... they've got a death rite. They're about fertility. They're about getting the crops to grow, getting your wife to have children, particularly sons in most of the cultures. And you strike a deal, you hope, with the gods, and you make little sacrifices. And it's about... death's a concern in them all, I think. But Christianity has got a particular... message about death. I mean, it's born in a cemetery, Christianity, which is a fascinating place for religion to be born. But so I do think that there is, we can generalize about religion worldwide when we're really talking about a particular few big ones.
Judaism's very weak on the afterlife and didn't have an inviting afterlife at all. And then in the competition with Christianity, they've sort of semi-invented one. But it's still, what you say is quite wise, because it's still not a big part of Judaism. Mm.
And the life after death, I think humans will ask the question at some stage. At some stage or other, even in a busy culture where you can be kept entertained almost all the time, we nevertheless will at some stage ask ultimate questions about
Life after death. Maybe we'll turn to you, Greg. So you're a psychic medium. Now, I think from our conversations, we recognise that there's a great variety of types of psychics, and you can share a little bit about what you make of other psychics and so on. Now, The Sixth Sense is a fantastic movie. I'm not sure if anyone's seen it. Anyone seen The Sixth Sense movie? Yeah. It's about a boy who communicates with spirits who don't know they're dead. Is this your experience? You know, it's got the famous line, I see dead people.
Yep.
Is this your experience of being a psychic medium, and is this something that you should expect?
It doesn't actually happen like it does in the movies, like Hollywood's damn me when I'm doing the same thing. Probably back on the question before about the death thing, I think some people warp religion or faith based on their own personal perception, as they will use death as a control mechanism in some facets of life, and if you've seen what's happened in London recently with that soldier being murdered and that, I think the fundamental belief system within a culture are probably pure, but people warp it for their own purposes in some way. Saying that though,
the psychic world or the mediumship world, it's not like you see dead people all the time.
Right.
But we have a very strong faith and belief that we all pass on to a place. Where it differs is that not a lot of psychics believe that hell actually exists. So they believe in everyone goes in the afterlife, and there's different levels. So what they might call the astral plane, where those lost souls are, that may be a form of hell based on that experience. So Hitler or Pol Pot, some of that might be stuck in limbo based on that stuff where they are. The majority of psychics believe that we all pass into the afterlife and we can connect with that aspect of the soul. So that's where we probably differ on some things, yeah.
Sure, well, maybe we can just explore that a bit more. So is there a sort of a standard... So in the psychic world... Sorry, that sounds like a strange kind of thing to say, but in the psychic circles in which you gravitate or you would speak, is there a sort of a set or a standard kind of understanding of the afterlife? You kind of mentioned the astral plane or whatever, but is that agreed, or how do people kind of perceive this kind of spiritual dimension?
Yep. Most psychics actually go down the Buddhist line with the seven different levels. So you have your astral plane, then the dimensions above that, so there's seven dimensions in the afterlife. That's one aspect of it. It depends on who you speak to, and I can talk about now, but I believe in the industry. But
you can share your thoughts. Yeah.
I think 80% of psychics.
We'll try to beef up our YouTube hits.
That's right.
It's
something controversial. 80% of psychics are frauds.
How many?
80%. 20% of those. 10% of those are actually delusional. Maybe 10% are actually on the mark. The drain. If you want to go to the MBS this weekend, it's down there. And as I said this to you downstairs, there's people going to that place and they're putting their life in the hands of somebody who's going to flip a car. How stupid is that? But they do, and people do. And then people proclaim to see their dead grandmother and say, "Oh, your grandmother's here, she loves you, she used to bake and drink tea and bake cookies." And they take that and they cry. And it's quite disheartening from my perspective to see people out there propagating crap like that.
So do you not believe that there's anything in the card thing?
No.
On what basis would you say that's nonsense? I'm just curious on what basis. Why would you say that's crap? But
because people go and do like a 10-week course, they learn what the meaning of the cards were. They say they're speaking to their guides, but all they're saying is the Three of Swords, meaning a relationship breakup. I can teach anyone in this room tonight to read tarot cards. You don't have to be psychic. And that is the truth. And there's people out there doing that. That's why I say the cards themselves are 2,000 odd years old. They come from, I think, Judaism was more that originally. But there's a lot of people out there just screwing up people's lives. So, yeah. But
I mean, I think that's incredibly refreshing you say that, because, like,
I told you we're better together. You
yeah. I mean, so I would see the Christian approach to, you know, I actually make mounted offence of the Christian approach, because even though I don't believe in it, you know, it's reasonably consoling, and, you know, I don't see too much exploitation. So you don't see many Christians getting into a plane and ploughing into a building on the basis of their belief in the afterlife, which I think you've seen in another religion. So, you know, and you don't see Christians generally giving too much hope to the grieving relatives of the dead. So they're the two major crimes that could come out of a too enthusiastic belief in the afterlife. First of all, you sacrifice your life and other people's life on a frivolous, trivial basis. Or secondly, you can be exploited. And they're the big problems with the belief in the afterlife.
That's my issue to the exploitation.
Yeah, yeah. And I say basically, most mainstream people of faith in Australia don't commit those two crimes.
I suppose most belief systems have an opportunity for some degree of exploitation and fraud.
That's right.
The question is to whether that is sustainability, that is part of the base understanding of that particular belief system or not.
Most of the funerals I go to would be Uniting Church, and they talk about, you know, their faith, their belief, not the cast iron promise or reality of the afterlife. So it's their faith in the afterlife. So they're upfront. They say, quite transparent, we've got a faith. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't actually, you can choose to believe or not believe, but you can't actually say that that's a dishonest statement.
Mm.
Or even dishonourable. It's not even a dishonourable statement.
Well, actually, there's been a couple of other questions for you now, Greg. Someone's asked, with respect, and I said, oh, what is this going to say?
Yeah, that's always mean. You know you bug it when you get it with respect.
So I appreciate the respectfulness. But how do we know whether you are a fraud or not?
You don't. that's the thing, is that you don't actually know. And that's the thing with anything. I was saying before about the love stuff, is that it's a faith thing. And when I do one-on-one consultations, and I have someone sitting in front of me, and I might see you, and I just say, I've got this child who's named Jack, and you've just lost a child named Jack. Well, what's the randomness of that? And so that's where I suppose my belief comes in. But I don't do a lot of one-on-one stuff. Mine's more about my own personal journey and how I've. My belief in the afterlife switched from the Roman Catholic side to more of a spiritual side. And look, it's my personal journey, but I try not to take advantage of people in grieving situations. That's my big thing, is if someone's got grief going on, I'm very, very wary of dealing with that, because if someone has lost, say, a 17-year-old kid who's committed suicide, unfortunately, my industry doesn't think too much about the person. They think about how good they are, or I got this, or I got that. They forget about that person just lost a 17-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were talking before, is that my journey over the last 18 months is I've gone down to more of a counselling therapist side of things. So it's very strange for me now to be in the therapist side, where I can deal with somebody through grief and stuff like that. So back to the question, no, you don't know. You really don't. And my point is that I can do what I like and say what I want. If you don't believe me, I'm not going to change that. And that's okay, because I can't change a Muslim from being Muslim to Christian, or a Jew from being Jewish to Christian, or an atheist to back to Christianity. Your belief's your belief, your belief's your belief. And as long as we're actually good people and do the best, that's what I believe in. As long as you're actually trying to do the best for yourself and your family and society, then who are you actually harming? So
yeah, there's a bit of a debate about, of course, you know, moral.
Yeah. Moral, well, we can probably touch on that again in the future. But thanks for sharing that, Craig. But so just intriguing, and so just a bit of clarification. So is it possible to communicate with the dead?
I believe it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the right circumstances.
So have you experienced that at some point?
I'm sure that a lot of people here may have actually just, like, one night felt a presence around, or felt maybe that your grandfather, or had a dream about somebody who's passed over. That's a form of communication as well too. So there are ways that can do it. I mean, I used to feel like when I was 5 or 6 years old, I used to see my dad standing outside my bedroom. It was sort of surreal that time, about 5 or 6 years old, but the child itself, the child has no barrier. We see what we see. It's when we get older we start putting the blocks in. But so it's, you can, with the right intention.
Right, okay. And so what sort of things do the dead people want to communicate? How do they, I'm just intrigued to hear more about, you know, I think you mentioned before, the question we often ask of a, you know, dead relative, are they okay? You know, how are they doing? What's life like on the other side?
Yep.
What are some of the things that they may be trying to communicate or trying to say?
That's about it, yeah.
They're okay.
One, they're alive. We love you. We miss you. We watch you. We'll meet you again. Keep your chin up. And everything's going to be okay. And we're safe. And if I've lost somebody, then the questions I want to answer, where are they? Are they okay? But also, once you make that connection with somebody who's passed over, then your fear of death may go, well, actually, I know there's an afterlife, so I know that if I'm a good person, I'm going to go into a good space. So you start to feel good about yourself. You start living life rather than, like before talking about the fear of death, what it does to you is you start living life rather than fearing death, and my God, you start to really just explode. So, and that's what I suppose the message I've had is that live life in the moment. Plan the future, but tell the person next to you that you love them. Tell them that the most important thing in your life ever, because you never know when, bang, stuff, it's gone. And we've always had tragedy in our life, and I've lost someone pretty quickly and pretty unexpected. What would you give to have one day back with that person? What would you say to them? That's what comes up. So.
That's right. Thank you, Gary. There's a number of reactions from that. I suppose we can other areas of going. I suppose maybe bring you into here now, Ian, because I wonder perhaps if there's some people that we kind of hope that they aren't okay. Like we kind of feel that, that you know, for example, the Stalins and so on, the Pol Pots and so on. We sort of say, well, how's he doing? He's okay. Well, hang on, I'm not so happy about that. But also there's a story in the Bible, I think, somewhere about where someone does talk about that things aren't actually so okay. They just kind of communicate from the dead. Do you want to... What are your thoughts?
Just before that, a lot of what Greg's saying about live lovingly now, you know, embrace what's happening in front of you and receive life as a gift from God and go for it. Or just receive life as a gift from wherever and go for it. I mean, and the care for those who've lost... absolutely. The reason why when Greg talks about that, I don't know exactly what to make of it, and that's fine. There's a huge amount of everything I don't know what to make of. I hear people's opinions and I'm interested. I've heard lots of people talk about near death. It's like, you know, where they've died clinically, not biologically.
Come on, sing the slipper, you didn't. Stop hedging your missing.
But I think
right in the ghoulies.
But since you directed to the story I'm thinking of, where Jesus, and this came to me when my grandmother, after I became a Christian, said, Wallace is dead. He probably wasn't a Christian. If he's not a Christian, I don't want to get to heaven. There's a whole lot of stuff about Wallace, whether he was or he wasn't, blah, 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 blah. But I went and talked to an older Christian that I knew and said, oh, I've got the faintest clue how to respond truthfully or usefully to her. And he introduced me to that story that you mentioned, where Jesus talks. It's one of Jesus. It's not a parable. It's a story Jesus tells about two guys who die. One guy finishes up in hell. He's in torment in hell. He seeks for relief in hell, and he's told there is no relief. He then remembers he has five brothers who presumably are like him, wealthy and enjoying life as he was. Because the picture of this man is that every day was Christmas for him. It was in the way Jesus paints this picture in Luke 16. He then begs for a message to go back to warn them of this place. So he wants his brothers to get a hellfire and brimstone preacher, which is all of our worst nightmare. And Jesus telling this story says they don't need it. They have the scriptures. The guy who's dead says, no, but if someone goes back from the dead, they'll believe. Full of irony, because Jesus knows this is what's going to happen to him. And Abraham in the story says, no, if they will not believe the scriptures, neither will they be persuaded that someone comes back from the dead, which is exactly what happens when Jesus both dies and comes back. And so, according to Jesus, and that's perhaps just one of the stories, the way that he discusses life after death is that, well, it's summed up in another verse which says it is appointed unto every person once to die and then follows the judgment. And if what Jesus says is true, unless he's lying, to put it baldly, it's hard to work out how what Greg says fits into what. So I'm sort of confronted with a choice. I've got what Jesus says about life after death. I've got what Greg experiences, and I'm going to go with Jesus on this because I think he has proven beyond any sensible doubt that he is qualified to speak, even though Greg is the one.
well, that's a reaction from the one. So, Greg, I suppose it would be interesting to hear what your thoughts on what Ian says, but also are there times, again, from your experience in this sort of engagement as being a medium in this point, where there are people who communicate that actually, I'm not so okay, this is not so fun, it's a bit hot here, etc., etc., you know, wish you weren't here. Like, I don't know, what are your thoughts?
It's always a very touchy subject, and an example is, let's say, I'm seeing a young lady whose father sexually abused them. That's, well, your dad's in heaven. No, he's not. So you sort of, there's always a healing place that I believe that, that people who have done things, they tend to go to a place where they get to relive or get to see the impacts they've made on other people and get to feel the emotions they've done to other people in their life.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.